Welcome to the B-Side, a sociology podcast on the cutting edge of thought on Black culture, politics, and materiality, and much more. The B-Side is a Sociocast production. For more, visit sociocast.org. We're your hosts,
Corey Fields
and me, Leslie Hinkson. And so each episode, we invite a guest on to talk about their work and its impact on their academic field. And then we ask them to engage in discussion on two topics of interest in current events. The first relates in some way to their areas of research and expertise. And the second topic, which we're calling I Know You Didn't Ask Me, But, is our op-ed section, if you will, where we ask guests to weigh in on topics, not because they're experts, but because they're intelligent thinking people with unique perspectives. So today's guest is Victor Ray. Victor is an assistant professor of sociology and criminology at the University of Iowa. His most recent American Sociological Review piece, published in January of 2019, is titled A Theory of Racialized Organizations, which I love. Victor, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
Good mm-hmm. to see you, man. The last time I saw you, we were like gallivanting around Paris.
Yeah, we were on a river cruise under the Eiffel Tower. So.
Yes, yes. It felt very glamorous at the Race in the Marketplace conference, which if you haven't heard about, you should check out. Not only do you get to go to cool places and hear smart people, you find guests for your podcast.
Yeah, I was like, what was I doing at that moment? Probably doing laundry.
It was really an incredible conference.
Yeah,
it was really great people, interdisciplinary. I learned a lot. And I'm actually excited to go back. I'm going to do a visiting scholar at the University of Paris Dauphine in the spring for a couple of weeks.
Oh, awesome. Awesome.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. Was that something that you had worked out going into this trip or?
That happened at the trip.
Wow.
Oh, nice. Nice. Damn, you had a better trip than I did. I don't get to go back. I got a specific note saying, keep your ass in the States.
Oh, you're wow.
no longer welcome in Paris.
Well, I will probably be visiting you, Victor. So just so you know. Okay, so Victor, before we get to your work, we asked you, as we do every episode, to pick an A-side track. What did you pick and why?
First, I want to say that this was the single hardest thing to decide on when coming on the podcast. I'd listen to music basically all day long as I work, so mm-hmm. it was really hard to narrow it down. But I chose Lupe Fiasco's Wave Files.
Nice.
And I chose it for a couple of reasons. One, it's the kind of thing I listen to when I write. The lyrics are complex, but it's kind of mellow, so it allows you to not necessarily totally focus on the music and sort of get into the zone. Well, Lupe has long been one of my favorite MCs. I think he is just incredibly creative. And this song, I think, relates to my work in some ways. So Lupe has a long section of the song in which he's just sort of reciting the names of various slave ships. Mm-hmm. And if you think about the history of American business, the foundation of American organizations, it's really tied in many ways to racialized slavery. So yeah, that's the reason I chose that song after panicking about what song I was going to choose.
And Victor, I am so pleased that this is the song that you chose, because you will see, listeners out there, that it actually relates to a later segment of the podcast. Before I get ahead of myself, Victor, let's talk about your work. You know, as I said in the intro, I really loved your ASR piece.
Thank you.
But I also know that that's not the totality of your work. So starting with your theory of racialized organizations, what prompted you to think about organizations as being central to our understanding of race and racism and racialized processes? Because let me tell you, I was so excited when I saw this, because I was like, oh yeah, the missing piece, like the mezzo. Oh,
thank you.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about your motivation.
So I think there's a bunch of ways I can answer this question. One way I think about this question is Charles Mills's book, The Racial Contract.
Mm-hmm.
had a sort of outsized influence on my thinking. I read it as an undergrad, and then I have reread it I don't know how many times. I teach it all the time. But in that book, he does a number of things. But one of the things he does is he looks at the history of philosophy, and he shows sort of the strategic places in which philosophy thinks it's not talking about race, but really is. Mm-hmm. And so as I was working on my dissertation on race and gender in the military, which was, you know, my dissertation project, I was told by Louise Seamster, my partner, to read Joan Acker's work on gendered organizations. And I read Joan Acker's work and I was like, where is this for race? Yeah. And that's another way that Charles Mills' book was really influential in my thinking, is that he was actually taking the racial contract from an earlier book called The Gender Contract. Even as an undergrad, I was like, oh, this is a smart thing to do career-wise, to find something that is established in another area and bring that to your area. Mm-hmm. And so I was working on my dissertation. I was told to read Joan Acker's work. I was like, this work is amazing. I can't believe I didn't read this in my coursework. But where is this for race? Why doesn't race theory have a theory of organizations? Mm-hmm. And so I had to finish the dissertation. I didn't start the paper right then. But when I finished my dissertation, that was actually the first paper I wrote. Mm-hmm. And then spent 4 years in peer review, finally ended up at ASR. And obviously, I was very happy about that. Like the racial contract, the paper started out as sort of a critical race critique of organizational theory, right? So I read a bunch of organizational theory, and I was like, so they're talking about race, but it's, as I say in the paper, it's seen as sort of an individual identity or a demographic feature, right? They're not talking about how JP Morgan Chase and Citibank were literally founded on the trade of human bodies. And so there was this way in which I thought they were sort of eliding questions that were central to me. They were missing something that they needed to be explaining. So yeah, that was sort of the long genesis for the paper.
Right. And so what is your theory? What is at the core of your theory?
So there's a couple of parts. One is that racial processes are built into organizations, right? And so we typically think of race as, oh, this person's Black, this person's white, right? And what I'm talking about is sort of things like how race justified the frontier. Mm-hmm. And the clearing of the frontier, right? And if you think of like the classic books in organizational theory on like the railroads, right? They talk about contracts, but they don't talk about the fact that like a literal genocide was carried out in order to create the conditions for some of those organizations to form. So that's one part of it. Another part of it is that, so when you read race theory and in leading folks in race theory, so I'm thinking about like Tanya Golash-Boza has a relatively recent piece in Sociology of Race and Ethnicity, or if you look at work like Omi and Manat, a great work, you know, I really like the work and I build on it. But oftentimes you hear them talk about macro micro linkages. And I'm like, it's true that the level of the state and laws shape race a lot. And it's true that individual prejudice matters a lot. But in between there, you have a ton of space where organizations are sometimes challenging and sometimes reinforcing the broader racial order. Mm-hmm. So there was a paper that came out, I think today or yesterday, in Science that showed this algorithm from a single company. Mm. I'm not going to get the exact findings right, but it's systematically disadvantaging Black folks to the point where they're not getting treatments that they could get, right? And so if you think about race only operating at the level of the state or only operating at the level of individuals, you miss how organizations can literally shape population level health. And so what I was trying to do was not say that the state and individuals aren't important, because clearly they are, but say that like we also need to think about how organizations shape sort of individual opportunities to carry out certain kinds of discrimination, or how they push the state to alter laws in certain ways, right? That can advantage or disadvantage certain racial groups.
Or also how they take, you know, let's say racial policies, right? And also meanings associated with race, like at that macro level, and turn those into these more meso level policies and practices that in the everyday life of individuals actually influences the ways in which race shapes their opportunity, shapes their outcomes, and also helps them to understand where they lie in the racial hierarchy in ways that are much more abstract from the state level.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I thought one of the cool things about the article for me, it's like the, essentially what you just laid out, this sort of dual interconnected, but sort of separate way. So it made me think about the ways in which organizations exist because of race and racialized thinking and racialized practices, right? On the one hand, so like as you were saying, like you wouldn't have JP Morgan Chase if not for some race shit, right? But then there's this like second parallel where it's like, then you also can see how race operates through organizations or within organizations, right? So that's less a story about, you know, the source of this organization's wealth or power or existence is grounded in racialized thinking, and more about like how does racialized thinking manifest in the practices within this organization. And it's interesting because like they're separate but obviously related questions, but what I love about the piece is that it plants the seed for such a wide range of work. So like I could see coming out of this an analysis that looks at, you know, how just randomly picking an organization because I'm in the office, right? How Georgetown University comes to exist because of race and racism.
Right.
But then it also sets the ground for me to think through how is Blackness recreated and reinforced through the practices of Georgetown University, right? Like, and those are two separate questions, but like—
But they're clearly related, yeah.
They're clearly related, but it's also like both would make awesome dissertations. And one of the most impressive things about the piece to me is that it actually does generate thinking around such a broad range of sort of ideas. I mean, it's really cool. It's nice because like there's a lot there, but you set it up such that it's like, yeah, no, like it's a great framework, but there's a lot of room to go in different directions with stuff. So it's like reading the piece, I found myself thinking like, yeah, like this isn't setting up any sort of guideline of like, this is how organizations work, right? But it does push me to think, how do organizations work in relation to race? You know,
I have been thinking about this for a really long time. And I mean, one great example, I think, is thinking about Brown v. Board of Ed, right? And so you have this change in the law, right? You know, at this, you know, this huge macro institutional level. Right?
Yeah.
What happens in school districts? What happens in individual schools vis-a-vis actual desegregation and then beyond desegregation, thinking about, you know, integration, right? Beyond just being like, okay, we're going to get some Black bodies in there, but we're going to keep them separate from everybody else, right? I think like this, that example to me is this great example of how you can actually see change, you know, at the macro level without seeing change at the individual level.
Yeah.
And also seeing the ways in which organizations choose, right? How are we going to respond, right, to these two different levels? How do we respond to, let's say, white parents and their, you know, concerns about having Black children in the same classroom as their kids? But then how do we also respond to the state who's telling us that by law we must do this? And I think that organizational level, that meso piece, I think is so important in thinking about and interrogating what structural racism actually looks like. You can't interrogate it. You can't examine it without having organizations in the picture.
So I think that's absolutely right. So I talk about the shifting mechanisms in the piece, and I use folks like Carolyn Tyson's work and to talk about how a lot of schools responded by racialized tracking.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of schools have resegregated to the point where, you know, some estimates say it is now worse than prior to Brown v. Board. I would point to some of my other work with Louise Seamster on when we talk about racism as a fundamental cause, borrowing fundamental cause theory as it's used in medicine to talk about how mechanisms shift in ways that reproduce white dominance. And sometimes a narrow focus on a single mechanism can miss sort of the broader picture, right? So if you look at a lot of schools and you're like, okay, schools have, in some cases, this is an integrated school. If you look at sort of just the numbers of Black and white students in the building, right? But then if you look at the internal processes and you see different rates of discipline, right? You see differential discipline, you see test score gaps increasing, or you see segregated tracking, or you see different levels of preparation or the number of students that are going on to college, you know that there's some sorting mechanism. Or if you see, you know, that the fact that the racial achievement gap typically increases over the course of schooling, that there's some internal mechanism in schools that even though these are nominally integrated spaces, are still serving, I mean, for lack of a better term, white group interests.
Right. I mean, you talked about this earlier, but like explicating the pathways between micro and macro, right? And it's like, we certainly talk about this in the abstract in sociology a lot, and everyone sort of head nods to it, and no one thinks that, you know, it's just like one or the other, and they're sort of like intertwined. But it does seem like it's through organizations that stuff gets transmitted from top down or bottom up, right? Like, how do I engage with the state if not through the IRS or through the DMV or through a school, right?
Or through a school or through your workplace.
Right, right, exactly. Like, and how do I engage with capitalism if not through a store or through my job? Yeah, so I mean, what I like about the idea is it forces us to think through the organizations as the location where the micro and the macro come together, right? Like that happens in this sort of mezzo space. And, you know, within those spaces, you have some micro shit going on. Like, I'm interacting with my coworkers and that's very micro, right? And then you also have some very macro kind of stuff happening where, like, you know, there's sort of broad state principles in play that I, you know, have to think through as guidelines on, you know, I don't know, how I teach or whatever. But it's like that place is where the transaction is happening, where the connections are going. What I love about the paper, it's sort of implicit. It's not like anyone would sort of deny that. Like, any set of scholars from the two bodies of work you bring together, like org studies and race studies, like everyone would be like head nod, like, yeah. But I think what you call out in the paper in a really compelling way is that we need to think about doing that as a focused, guided area of study, like being explicit in talking about that. I kind of will turn the critique on myself here, right? It's like, well, you know, I studied an organization and how race played out in it. And like, obviously this stuff was in play, but I think your work pushes me to think through like, no, you need to be explicit in both, but calling out what you're doing, right? Because it's not enough to just sort of be like, oh, right, this happened in an organization, because stuff, of course, has to happen in an organization, right? Yeah, it's like really compelling. I did have a question about it.
No.
It's not an uh-oh question. In some ways, it's probably thinking about even expanding it, thinking about connecting that micro-macro organizations at the tool.
Okay, yeah.
Now, the paper, I read organizations as sort of formal organizations, right? Presumably, the principle extends to these sort of mezzo-institutions more broad, because I was thinking like, well, is family an organization that would count in this? But like, obviously, in the paper, you're talking about formal organizations.
In the paper, I'm talking about formal organizations. So this is something that I think it comes through in sort of the new institutionalism differently than it does in other areas of sociology. And this was something that I think happens in the race literature a lot, is organization and institution are often used interchangeably.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Whereas in the organizations litter, organizations are nested within broader institutions, right? So you'll have the law or family, it's sort of a broad institution. Mm-hmm. When I say those words, there's kind of a generalized understanding of what they are, what they look like, how they operate. And then you have organizations in some ways contesting those things, or in some ways, you know, reinforcing assumptions about, say, the law or the family.
Okay.
And so what I was trying to do was to say that race theorists would actually benefit from using that distinction that organizational theorists have pretty clear, right? Mm-hmm. Because I think, you know, I just cited a couple of really good school ethnographies, right? But we could also think about how schools have been central in pushing the state to undermine the legacy of Brown v. Board.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not just those internal processes. So I forget the name of the Supreme Court case, but the Seattle versus whoever Supreme Court case in which some of the protections of Brown were eroded, right? And so that is an organizational process that's actually pushing the state and changing the entire institution of schooling or secondary education more broadly, right? One way I think about this a lot is sort of these free speech debates that are playing out on campuses all across the country. So free speech is an institution, right? Legally enshrined, broadly understood. Organizations are dealing with that very differently, right? Some universities are saying these white supremacists who are attempting to come and speak cannot. It's a safety risk. It's going to put our students at risk. Some are saying, let a thousand flowers bloom. And yes, of course, white supremacists could come and speak here. And I think, you know, if this goes to the courts, we could have a sort of new institutional understanding, depending on how the courts decide, that organizations would, again, then contest, but would force in some ways a new kind of compliance. Mm-hmm. I don't think this made it into the paper, but one of the things I think a lot of organizational ethnographies do is it's kind of like they think of the organization as sealed. Mm-hmm. And I was saying, on the one hand, yes, there are processes that are internal to that organization. So I have a paper, you know, for future work that I presented at ASA this year on Airbnb as a racialized organization. And one of the things that Louise and I talk about in that paper is Airbnb on its website, they've since taken it down. But when we started doing this research, they literally had on their website rules for how guests could evade the Fair Housing Act.
Oh, my goodness.
And because, you know, the Fair Housing Act had, and this makes sense if we think about the time it was passed, the Fair Housing Act excluded owner-occupied housing, like bed and breakfast and things like that, for whatever reason, right? The politics of the day. But Airbnb had on their website, I mean, I can like send you the document because I screen capped it, but it was like, these are when it doesn't apply to you, right? So if you think about Airbnb and discrimination, you could think about that Harvard Business School study that showed, you know, Blacks had a 15% less response rate if they were trying to rent. But you don't think about their power to undermine sort of a foundational document of the civil rights movement that allowed Black folks to give up the Green Book and go to hotels.
Yeah,
right.
Not that the individual level stuff doesn't matter, because it absolutely does, but that undermining, to me, that is a bigger issue, right? Mm-hmm. Of allowing a new kind of segregation to emerge that is under the table and much, much harder to fight, or at least people haven't developed the tools to combat in the same way.
You know, that kind of reminds me of, you know, the huge explosion in this like diversity and inclusion or diversity, equity and inclusion work that's going on across organizations, across sectors, all across this country, right?
Yeah.
And it's interesting because I ask organizations, why now? Why are you hiring a full-time D&I expert? Why are you changing your strategic plan right now? And every single organization seems to have a different answer. But part of me believes that even though they might have these very different, like sort of tiny reasons for it, oh, well, because everyone's doing it, you know, or because, oh, we think diversity is a good thing. They're all actually responding to a number one, you know, something bigger within society right now. Mm-hmm. But also number two, the fact that they actually believe that they can institute policies and practices at the organizational level to help change the behavior of individuals within that organization. And I think that that's actually another way. And I would love for someone to actually write something like using this frame, right, of the ways in which, you know, the sort of D&I space is actually in some ways an illustration of the importance of the organizational level and thinking about what racialized organizations look like, right? And how racialized organizations respond to, I don't know, shocks at both the macro and the micro level. Well, I'm not going to do it. I'm just saying. I mean, I think that that's an example of something that's happening in real time, right? You know, it's not like one organization is saying, you know, I'm going to do that. I mean, we can think of this as an example of isomorphic mimeticism, right?
Right.
Yeah.
But in response to what? Like, what actually is helping those dominoes to fall down and saying, okay, we're all going to do this at this moment in time? What is going on, right, at the societal level that is prompting organizations to say, yeah, we need to put some money into this?
I mean, that sort of specific empirical case is interesting because, I mean, it's a multi-drive, right? Because presumably it's partly the diversification of workspaces and customer bases. So essentially, institutions or organizations are having to manage having some level of difference. And they're all in practice, right? So it's like, well, we have Black people around here now, and simultaneously, Black people don't have to be put up with, treated like shit explicitly. We could get sued. So now a whole elaborate institutional response develops around that. Because at the same time, we know the white people who work here aren't going to stop treating the Black people like shit. So how do we navigate that?
I think I have a lot of questions in response to this. One is that I'm not sure it's increasing right now, that more businesses are adopting diversity and inclusion initiatives, but they might be, right? I think the ones that get me the most are typically in response to an exogenous shock, right? So we can think of the Starbucks incident in which they, you know, had called the police on two Black men who had been in Starbucks for something ridiculous like 30 seconds. And in response, Starbucks closed its stores and did a implicit bias training, right? Which the evidence on implicit bias training is not great. And so I think that they were responding to, you know, there was a brief moment of people saying we need to boycott Starbucks. I think when the Airbnb paper, the working paper from the folks at the Harvard Business School first went up, Airbnb had a similar response. And it's interesting, they hire like the same five people. It's like Eric Holder.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I'm serious. There's like a few other people that like, we brought in Eric Holder, everything's okay.
Stop trying to take jobs from high profile Black people, Victor.
I'm not trying to take his job. I mean,
no, I'm not talking about these big spectacular cases where you then say, okay, we're going to bring Eric Holder in for like a one-off seminar and then he's going to be on our board.
Yeah.
Actually, we have seen over the past, I would say 4 to 5 years, right, a significant increase, not just in the policies and practices within organizations concerning D&I in terms of initiatives, but actually hiring full-time staff.
I see.
Who are responsible for ensuring that, okay, diversity and inclusion and now equity is part of it. It used to be just D&I, now it's DE&I. We're seeing this happen. And simultaneously, we're actually also seeing organizations that specialize in trainings and workshops for diversity, equity, and inclusion actually increasing around the country. I mean, it is a money-making proposition. And so that is what fascinates me.
Yeah, it is. Do you know of any work on this? So I know of like Frank Dobbin's work that looks at sort of the specific outcomes, you know, don't be coercive. Those things are shown to sort of help increase. But I don't know of any work looking at this particular increase.
It is an interesting illustration of thinking through some of the stuff that comes up in the article, right? Because actually, it absolutely makes me think of internal organizational practices that start to structure how individual people within those organizations understand themselves as racialized actors, right? The diversity, equity, and inclusion presentation and folks, like that whole department, I think, you know, what they do, certainly in terms of at a rhetorical level, certainly has a way of shaping how people feel like they can and can't talk about who they are or what they are, right? Like in terms of like racial identity, which has a ripple effect, right? Like it's precisely the point you're making, right? What's happening within this organization is actually starting to shape how people come to understand themselves as individuals on this micro level shit, which is not at all disconnected from how people want to be categorized at the state level.
Which is why I'm just throwing it out there as a gift to someone listening who may be looking for a project.
You know, in some ways, Leslie, it is an interesting and underexplored context. I think about Ellen Berry's work and Amaka, who we had on last week, talking about sort of like this sort of shift to diversity talk and some of the implications of that. But I think, yeah, like thinking about it through the lens of, you know, racialized organizations opens up a whole new avenue in terms of thinking through it. I did have one quick question, because I also want to hear what's next now that you've like dropped a bomb and created a whole new universe of sociological research. But to talk about the theory of racialized organizations, reading the paper, one could walk away with the sense of there's no such thing as a non-racialized organization. It's a theory of race in organizations, right? So like every organization is a racialized organization.
So I would say this, what would a non-racialized organization look like? Again, I started by saying race is an identity, but it is also a social structure. So I'm building on Benia Silva's work on racialized social systems, Omi Wanant's work. And if we think of race as a social structure, if we take that idea seriously, I'll use the analogy to capitalism, right? Capitalism, whether I want it to or not, shapes how I interact with my son, because I can buy him toys, I can provide basic healthcare for him, I can, right? What I'm saying about race and organizations, and the reason that I think the idea of organizations not having that is whether we like it or not, race influences organizational processes a lot of times in ways that we don't necessarily think about if we think of race just as an identity, right? I say it in the paper, all organizations are racialized in some way, right? They're inhabited by people who have race. And racism is, you know, if you look at the social psych literature, people call it an automatically processed category, right? Once it is out there as a structure, it influences things. That's how I answer that. If we think race is a social structure, we have to think about the ways it shapes things beyond sort of the typical measures we have in sociology. What's next is I'm working on two projects. One is an edited volume with Jenny Mueller. We just sent it out to some folks to review. So I don't know if people are familiar with Jenny Mueller's work on white ignorance and racial ignorance. And we're tentatively calling this the racial structure of sociological thought. So Jenny and I were like talking about our individual work. Both of us draw from Charles Mills in different ways. Sort of I was showing how organizational theory produced a kind of ignorance around the way race works in organizations. She is like much more explicitly drawing on Charles Mills' theory of racial ignorance to talk about how white folks develop ignorance around race. And so, you know, I applied that to organizational theory. So we've asked a bunch of folks from different areas of the field to contribute individual chapters, sort of doing the same thing, talking about how their field deals with or doesn't deal with race and what that means for our thinking about race in the discipline sort of more broadly. The second project is I'm trying to expand the ASR into a book. Mm-hmm. You know, when you work on an article like that for a long time, a lot of stuff gets cut, a lot of stuff gets changed. But I want to spend some time in the book kind of rewriting the history of organizational theory to put race at the center. And so to look at a bunch of the classic works and show sort of how they evade or what that work would look like if you placed race at the center.
What's been the reaction to the piece? Like, I can imagine the race folks mostly taking the, you know, expansions you suggest in stride and sort of being like, yeah, mea culpa for not considering organizations. But the org folk, how have they responded to? I mean, I guess because I could see them being all like, whoa, wait a minute.
I would say overall, the response has been positive and, you know, congratulatory. I think, however, if it wasn't, like, how would I know? I wouldn't hear, right? Like, so those folks wouldn't, well, who knows, they might, because sometimes we get those emails, but I haven't gotten any of those emails. Harvard Business School asked me to write a piece. We'll see if they'll take it. I submitted it.
Okay.
They're editing it now. We'll see if they take it. I was super floored when they asked me because I was like, it's like a mainstream business outlet, right? But they've asked a lot of race scholars to write for them. They take it seriously and they think business folks need to take diversity seriously. So I was surprised by that.
Yeah.
I've been asked to give talks, things like that. One at a business school that I had to turn down for personal reasons, but it's been surprisingly good. I mean, I was actually worried that the org's response was going to be not great, but asked some org's folks to read it in one of the many, many iterations. And I think they were really helpful and they, you know, probably helped me cut out some excesses that would have ended up bad for me.
So Victor, what I wanted to talk about today when we sort of like move beyond your work, but talked about how your work informs, right, or may be informed by current events. I wanted to talk about that the story that just came out this week about Princeton's Theological Seminary and how they have entered into the reparations game without being shamed by a national news outlet, without having any ties to have actually owned slaves in the past. And they just sort of made this announcement and was like, we want to give $27 million towards reparations for slavery, because our institution did benefit from the slave trade.
Which, parenthetically, everybody should be shamed about the slavery situation and reparations. So, you don't need to find out your institution bought and sold slaves to feel shame about it.
Right.
For all you institutions out there with some extra endowment cash.
Right. This is a general malady, not...
Right.
I think that case in particular is very interesting. There have been some other places who have done it recently. Was it Georgetown?
Students voted for it, yeah.
The students voted for it at Georgetown.
It feels a little bit different because the Black students also have to pay it, so...
That's what's so interesting about this is that, yeah, that's just right. You know what I mean? And there are several institutions with huge endowments who did own slaves who still haven't done anything about it. And so the seminary comes out and says, oh, hey, we're doing this. And so I was wondering, Victor, whether or not your work, you know, can help us understand what's going on.
No, I think this case is really interesting. One, you know, in the paper, I argue that movements and exogenous shocks can get organizations to redistribute resources in different ways. So, you know, it's consistent. Two, as I was looking at that, I went back and read a piece by Tressie when I think Georgetown did this. And Tressie would argue that these aren't reparations, I think, right? In that piece, she said that this was more like a kind of affirmative action because they're not actually just like giving people money, right?
Right. They are not. I read the article and I was like, first I was like, oh, reparations. And I figured it would be some sort of semi-fake-ass reparations, like, oh, we're given to communities and da-da-da. But then I read the article and I was like, wait, it's a scholarship to go there?
It's a scholarship to go there. And one of the points that Tressie makes in that piece, she talks about, okay, so you get a scholarship to go to Princeton or Georgetown, and you still have to get through all the hoops to get to Princeton or Georgetown, right? She has this line in the piece, it's something like, you don't admit you owe someone money and then pay them with lottery tickets, right? So we know exactly how difficult it is because race is built into every step it takes to get into Princeton or Georgetown. So we know how difficult it is to get there in the first place, right? And so again, I think that this is better than nothing. It's a good start, but I don't know if it's reparations. Two, I think in this debate, there have been folks out there like Derek Hamilton making the academic case for reparations for years and coming up with proposals for years. And I kind of wish those folks were sort of highlighted more in these conversations, right? Because this was an idea that for so long was looked at like as if you were talking about reparations, people thought you were not all right. And so I think it's a testament to those folks, those scholars and activists who kept the faith for so long that some organizations are starting to respond this way.
Although it's interesting to think about this sort of organizational response. And this, again, circles back to your work, Victor, right? There's a part of me that feels like, while I say, take those seminary scholarship, Black people going to Princeton Seminary, and take the $15,000 on top of it, that take that money and spend it with grace. And any other organizations that want to do that, if ASA wants to come up with a Black People Reparations Fund, I will happily take the free conference registration, please. But I do wonder to what extent, as like individual organizations develop these practices, it forecloses the likelihood that there'll be a broader state response, or does it like push momentum and like the trickle up goes?
That's an open question, right? But I mean, I would like to think it pushes momentum, but you, it is equally likely that people are going to be like, you already got paid. So... stop asking. As I was thinking about this too, I was talking about like sort of JP Morgan Chase and Citibank, how, you know, some of those places have sort of been like, we're sorry for our role in the slave trade, but they haven't, you know, made any moves to reparations. I think it's interesting that it's schools and sort of seminaries that are doing it. I mean, we have what, three examples. So it's by no means a broad movement. Arguably the financial institutions that made the most aren't.
Yeah, no, for sure. JP Morgan Chase is for sure not giving nothing to Black people. I say that as a customer. They are still extracting.
I think that that's an important point too. The headlines for the seminary piece were all reparations for slavery. And I think, you know, the scholars who are really on this stuff are like, look, we got slavery, we got Jim Crow, we got mass incarceration, we got ongoing discrimination. We could make the argument of reparations for yesterday, right? Like not all the way back to slavery.
I got a faculty meeting on Wednesday. I feel like I could make a hard case for.
But I mean, like, seriously, I'm being serious.
No, I am too.
But like reparations for systematic underpayment, right?
Right. Yeah.
Louise and I talk about this original sin framing, and it was framed in the seminary piece specifically around like, this is our way to redeem ourselves. And like, it's not over yet. Again, you know, we could look at the admissions policies of your university and say some of this stuff is still ongoing.
Right. I mean, it certainly sets the stage for what seems like, you know, legitimate discourse around what's was taken and what mistreatment and what the consequences of inequality have been around. I like that original sin framing certainly means like, yes, talking about slavery reparations might be legitimate, but talking about the racial discrimination I just faced, you know, and how are you going to compensate me for that becomes like less legitimate. It's like, well, yeah. The development of language around repayment or like what's been taken from Black folks has been pretty, even within the reparations discourse, it certainly as it spread to more widely, has been constrained around slavery. Which, look, if I were fucking over people left or right the way white supremacy has, I would want to keep it narrow too. Because it's like...
Yeah.
Because it's like, right, if you start spreading it out, it's like, yeah, everybody being mistreated is like, well, wait a minute, you know? Like,
I mean, I think that's a good point. Yeah. I think you see this generally around people trying to define race or racism or discrimination, right? Is that like those inflicting or benefiting from these have a real incentive to keep the definition as narrow as possible.
Right.
Yeah, it displaces responsibility.
Good job, Princeton Seminary, but it's just the beginning. We not done yet.
You had a piece you wanted to talk about today for our I Know You Didn't Ask Me But segment. So would you like to introduce it?
Thinking of seminary related things, we're taping this on a Friday, what, October 25th, which was the day Kanye West's new album has dropped, as the internet and my phone and every outlet has been trying to tell me that I need to listen to it. I think I'm going to go, I was going to say hard pass, but soft pass, actually, to be fair. Look, musically, I've always been there for Kanye and been supportive, so I can't say it's a hard pass, but it's going to be a pass for me. But it seems like it's worth talking about. So Kanye's back with what's supposed to be a gospel album. And I guess it opens up interesting questions around how do you define the category of gospel album? I will not be able to opine deeply on this issue because, like I said, I'm not going to be listening to it. But yeah, so what have you guys heard about it? Have you guys listened to it? Are you planning to listen to it? Or is Kanye just over?
I'm totally planning on listening to it. I mean, I want to know. I mean, I think I mentioned this to you both. Like, I want to know whether he's talking about and to Jesus or about and to Yeezy, right? Which it seems to me, it's like to him, they're the same. And also too, I mean, come on, musically, he's done some brilliant things. And I want to see whether or not that brilliance is still there or whether or not that's deteriorating along with his common sense and much else. So I will listen to it. I will take my time listening to it as well, you know, just because I'm curious.
Fair enough. How about you, Victor?
I am curious, but I literally, before I came on the show, almost tweeted, no one is going to make me listen to this album. I stuck with Kanye long after Good Sense told me to stop sticking with Kanye. And yeah, I mean, he went beyond sort of, cancel culture is not a thing, but he's canceled.
It's not a thing, but I'm about to make it a thing.
I'm about to make it a thing. Yeah, he just went too far.
It's just too much because, like, look, there's plenty of good music. If we were at a state where, like, high quality hip hop and rap was, like, unavailable, and, you know, I would be like, he a fool, but I'm gonna have to check it out. But I kind of feel like right now it's like, look, my time is finite and I can't give energy to this foolishness because it seems like it's part and parcel of a broader story of foolishness from Kanye West. And he's certainly presenting it that way and marketing it that way because now he's, you know, I'm the victim. I can't do nothing. And, you know, people come after me for just trying to speak ideas. And it's just like this. I'm too tired.
If Kanye West were in one of your race classes, how would you respond, right? I would be like, I understand you have some thoughts, but you have not done the reading. You are not prepared. Right. And like, frankly, you do not know what you were talking about. Right. And if you wrote some of this on an exam, you would fail the class. I mean, you would fail at least that exam. I don't know about the class, right? The other thing is, I was thinking about this in terms of, you hear people say that to motivate themselves to do work, they'll like write a check to an organization they hate. And if they don't get the work done, they send that check. They have to do this. And so it motivates them to do work. When I think about myself streaming Kanye's new album, I'm like, nah, that's me sending that check. Even though it's pennies on the stream, he's getting paid and I just can't.
Well, I was planning on listening to it while I cleaned my refrigerator. And so, you know, it's not, this is work. I'm talking, this is work. And again, I'm listening to it, like, primarily out of intellectual curiosity. As much as I believe it is really just another sort of, like, marketing scheme or what have you, you know, this is a way to get, like, particularly Black folk to listen, you know, it's like it's gospel. Despite that, I'm gonna listen. Anyway, I'm like one of those women who courts bad relationships. So I'm just like, I know he's no good for me.
I'm not totally convinced that Black people are the intended audience for this, but I will say, like I said, mine is a soft pass. I'll be curious to hear what you think, Leslie. I'll be curious to hear how critics respond. Because it's like, word on the street is like, oh, it's life-changing and he's never been better and blah, blah, blah.
Oh, really?
If that's what it is, right. It's like, well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not.
Oh, if that's what it is. I was like, I didn't hear that.
I have a lot of stupid ass people that I still have in my life. So if it's amazing, I'm not saying that, like, I could never listen to Kanye West again. I think I'm just mostly saying I'm tired of him right now. And like I said, like, my energy is finite and this is not my ministry. So I'm going to just have to take a pass.
Tired is one way to describe it.
Type one way. You've been listening to The B-Side. Thanks to our guest Victor Ray from the University of Iowa. We'd also like to thank our young producer at Queens College, Jaylene Colon. And The B-Side is part of the growing Sociocast podcasting empire, and you can check out our sister programs at sociocast.org. On behalf of Corey Fields and myself, Leslie Hinkson, we want to thank you for joining us again.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This was fun.
Don't forget to hit us up on Twitter. Tell us what you think about the show. B-Side_podcast. podcast. And just want to also say my personal thanks for showing up, Victor. It was great having you.
To take us out, here's our B-side pairing to Victor's A-side selection, Nas's Warrior, for many, many reasons. First song that came to mind, you know, Lupe is one of Nas's disciples, and it's just an amazing song. Thanks again for listening, y'all.